We have a quorum. I'd like to bring the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. Representative Norton, would you make a motion to approve the minutes, please?
I certainly would.
Motion made to approve the minutes of February the 28th. Any corrections or questions? Not all of those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. All right, first bill up today, Representative Mariani. Representative Pawlowski, would you like to move the bill?
I'll move it.
House File 2126. And the motion that this bill would then be held over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, just a question. I had asked earlier whether or not there'd be a supplemental bill, and the answer was no. And now we're moving for possible inclusion into a supplemental bill, I assume, of some kind. So could you clarify, is this going to be a fiscal bill or a policy bill, or what will it be?
I believe this would be a policy bill.
So, Mr. Chair, just to be clear, there will be technically then no money in this bill, no finance.
Well, at this point, that's the way it looks, yeah. Everything is fluid, you know.
Yes, I'm familiar with the word fluid.
Yes.
We drowned in it last session.
Yeah, so I had a Dodge that had fluid transmission, too.
Yes, I had one, too, with the buttons on the side. It didn't work well. Okay, thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Okay. Representative Riccobino.
Just clarification, that bill would have no general fund money in it. Is that correct?
You're probably pretty correct.
Okay, that's good.
I think we're ready to proceed, Representative Mario. Welcome to this committee.
Thank you.
And we're always this congenial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you and I, many years ago, served on this committee together, and so it's good to circle back and be with you here again. Mr. Chair, members, this is really a pretty straightforward bill. House File 2126 addresses an unintended consequences when a few years ago we set out to really provide some strong quality control, regulatory control over vocational schools. And we did a number of things, including dictating that if they use the term institute in their name, they can only do so under certain meeting certain requirements. Well, one of the unintended consequences is we have a vocational school in my district, and I'll have our testifier share the terrific work that they do, that for well over 20 years has had the name Institute in their name, not for the sake of granting certificates or licenses, as you were properly focused on, but to provide language services for a diversity of clients so that they can go on with the rest of their lives pursuing higher education or other careers. And so what this bill would do is basically grandfather them in because they've had the word institute in their name. It's a trademark name. This is a local St. Paul, Minnesota-based company that recruits clients from around the globe, and so obviously their name is very important in terms of being able to maintain a consistent presence with their clientele. And so the bill would basically just grandfather them in and not subject them to the stringent and proper requirements that you have set forward for the vocational schools that use this name. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would ask our testifier to tell you a little bit about their school.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sheila Hoffman, and I'm the president of Global Language Institute. I am also one of the owners of GLI, along with my colleagues here, Mary Guillen, who is the Director of Admissions and Administration, and Art Carlson, who serves as CFO. Global Language Institute, as Representative Mariani has explained, is an English language school. We teach English to international students from around the world. In describing what we do, I often compare it to study abroad programs. When American college students study abroad in another country where English isn't the first language, they often need like a boost of language instruction before they can take some academic courses. And so that's what we do on the flip side. We have international students who come to us, many of whom want to go to college or university here, many who have already been accepted or are in the application process. But students also come just for personal enrichment reasons. And in that respect, we are an avocational school. We do not do any career training or job placement as part of our work. GLI was established in 1990 here in St. Paul. We're a small business. We're still located downtown St. Paul. And we are an accredited school. We're accredited by ASSET, which is the Accrediting Council for Continuing Education and Training, based out of Washington, D.C. ASSET is one of two boards authorized by the U.S. Department of Education to accredit avocational language programs like ours. And we've been continuously accredited without any complaints for since 1994. In the process of going through reaccreditation, as we do, we are required by ASSET to obtain a letter from the Minnesota Office of Higher Ed reaffirming our exemption from state licensure. And again, as we've said, as an avocational school, we have been exempt all these years. But when we were going through the process in 2010, 2011, I was informed by Mr. George Rodler at the Minnesota Office of Higher Ed that there had been a change in the statute, that it had been amended to say that avocational schools continue to be exempt from licensure as career schools, except in the case where they have the name college, university, academy, or institute in their names. And we do have the name institute in our name. And so this is problematic for us, I think, in a couple of ways. One important way is that, first and foremost, we're not a career school. We're not a vocational school. So from a very practical standpoint, we would probably not be successful in being licensed because we don't have a career curriculum. We have well-qualified faculty and staff, but not in career training. We, of course, don't do job placements, so we wouldn't be able to meet benchmarks and those types of things. In another way, it's difficult for us, it feels unfair to us in that, for example, there would be a language school just, you know, some miles away from us doing essentially the same work that we're doing, and simply because of the fact that their founder some decades ago chose their name, and our founder some decades ago chose the name Global Language Institute with the word institute, we would be subject to the requirement to undergo licensure as a career school, whereas they would continue to not as the avocational school that they are and as we are.
All right.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
The folks at GLI have been working with Minnesota Office of Higher Education on this language, and they're present here, and if you want, they can come forward. They're supportive of this effort.
Yeah, I think that would be good if they would come down. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. We substantially rewrote our licensing and registration statutes in 2008, and frankly, this is an oversight, and we should have done this differently at the time. So we have no problem with this bill.
All right. Any questions from members? Representative Epkias, I know you're on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to ask the author and his thoughts on this. He and I sit on the Education Reform Committee for K-12, and we have one of the things that we're looking at in that committee is, and we passed it out of committee the other day, or about a week ago, was that requiring those candidates who are going into public teaching, public school teaching, to pass a rigorous basic skills test. And in discussing this with others, sometimes because we do in our K-12, some of our K-12 schools have foreign language classes, and we often hire students of other languages that are proficient, and especially in the language immersion classes that I have about 10 of my schools in my district who have language immersion as a key issue in their schools. And the question can go to either you or the author, Representative Mariani, is would the programs that you're offering or that the Global Language Institute offering be appropriate for those students that come here to the University of Minnesota from other countries and then want to go into teaching and want to, you know, teach in the school, and then they're going to be required to pass the basic skills test in a higher learning environment. Do you have thoughts on that, Representative Mariani?
Representative Mariani?
Well, I'll make a stab at it. I think that the issue there is that when the state properly wants to be able to assess whether an individual has any particular type of skills relative to those kind of placements, that we then have tests and ways to assess that at that point. And so I could easily see a scenario where a foreign student would come here, be part of the, you know, participate in the GLI so that they can then prepare themselves better and hone their English skills as they then go on to take courses at the University of Minnesota. And if I would imagine it, if at some point then subsequent to that, that individual is looking for an opportunity to be placed in a K-12 setting, then the state would then have and does have an ability to assess at that point. Clearly, if we're talking about a licensed position, there's all the licensing requirements, including the one that we all voted for a week ago, requiring the passage of the metal test before obtaining the license. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think the issue here is sort of a subsequent issue. I don't think the GLI people would say that what they're doing is attempting to prepare people and then issue certificates or licensures for them to do that, to be placed in those kinds of positions of responsibility.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. But they could, excuse me, Mr. Chair, but they could work in cooperation with the university and other offices of higher learning throughout the state. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Debeke, I suspect so.
Thank you very much, Representative Mariani and Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about what would be the consequence of not doing anything? They must register as a private career school with the Office of Higher Ed. What exactly does that entail?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe, that means they would have to pay an annual licensing fee, and I believe they would also have to post a bond that in the event that they were to go out of business and there were students still remaining to be taught, that another business, you know, that bond would cover the cost of a teach-out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So have they been doing that for the last 4 years?
Ms. Rimes.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, I don't believe so. I believe we have not yet charged them the fee. We were about to charge them the fee when this arose.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Grimes, are there other schools that may fall into this that you haven't yet discovered, or are you absolutely sure this is the one and only that kind of fell through the cracks?
Describe.
Chairman, Representative Poppe, we know of at least one other one, the International Institute on Como in St. Paul, but we do not, we think there are at most two or three others that it would apply to, but those are the only two we know of for sure.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, then do all of those fall into the date and as it's the change that has been written?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, the ones we know about, they do, yes.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, then I think I have some questions for the Global Language Institute person as well. And you might have said this, I had trouble hearing you, so I'm just more curious than anything. So you have a group of students. I'm not sure how many students you actually have. Mm-hmm. How they pay for the schooling or the education they're receiving, the training they're getting, and what's your scope or geographic region that you are dealing with for students?
Sure. Sorry that you couldn't hear me earlier. I'm a little bit nervous. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I just didn't hear well.
The first question was?
How many students?
Yeah, we have approximately about
between 200 and 250, 300, I'm looking at my director of admissions here, students per year, typically between 50 and 75 at per session. Because we try to accommodate the academic schedules all around the world of when students are on breaks from school and such, we have very frequent start dates every 4 weeks, and so students tend to stay approximately 8 or 9 months, but they, at any given time, it's between 50 and 75 students. Our students come from all around the world, so the region is just, you know, the whole wide world that comes to GLI. And
Then how do they pay for school?
The students are self-paying. Sometimes they receive scholarships from their own countries, but they're not eligible, nor do they receive any kind of funding from us or from the United States at all. In fact, from our the accrediting board, we really are encouraged to not even have scholarships for students or anything like that, so we do not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so it's a global institute, I understand that,
yeah.
But these primarily would be students who live in the metropolitan area, or
no.
It's an online, or it's
no.
A Skype, or it's a, how no. How is it, or it's on paper?
Yeah, students apply to us from their countries around the world. And they come to us from their country specifically to learn English, and then again, either they go home, you know, for their own work or their own whatever their life plans are, just personal enrichment, improving with their improved English, or they go on to colleges or universities here before heading back.
So, Mr. Chair, just one final, so I understand. So, as they come to you, then. Again, I guess your geographic scope as far as it is global, but the students are coming to sessions that are located in the metropolitan area. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Hoffman?
Thank you. That's my question.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I think one of my questions was answered. There's Representative Mariani. Nice to see you. And is there about 3 or 4 is what they figure of these institutes or academies? In the state, sorry. My question would be, who oversees them as far as academically then, of what the course material is or whatever? Do you know?
Yeah. Representative Mariani, do you have?
Mr. Chair, and it looks like Ms. Grimes is coming forward, but
yeah.
Clearly GLI, you know, goes through their, through I forget the name of the accrediting body, but it's a national accrediting mm-hmm. body. I don't know about the others, and perhaps Ms. Grimes might have an idea.
Ms. Grimes, welcome back.
Thank you, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. It's a very good question. I'm not sure that there is regulation. If our statute was meant to be consumer protection for students who paid tuition for training that would lead to a career. And if the training is considered not vocational, avocational, they're not regulated by us.
Representative Vogel, any follow-up?
Okay, that's good.
Any other
okay.
questions?
Sure.
Representative
Ms. Hoffman.
Could you put your name tag up where I can
see? Yeah, I got it back.
Okay. Representative Rukavina.
Ms. Hoffman, you know, I noticed we got a number of Rangers in the room. We got former Senator Janicich, who works for Minsky, Mr. Klander, who's, I think, the director of the Minnesota University students, and behind me is Mr. Sirk Venix with the Private College Foundation, and myself. Do you think you can teach us proper English in a month or so?
In 9 short months?
How long would it take?
Mr. Chair, I would hope they would charge top dollar for that. That's quite a challenge.
It would be difficult. Okay. No more questions. Okay. If there are no more questions, then we will play over House File 2126 for possible inclusion, and we thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppy.
In the case that there may not be a combined omnibus kind of bill, would this ever be possible to go on its own? I mean, you're leaving that open.
That would always be a possibility. Okay, now next is House File 1803, Representative Riley. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an oral amendment if you would like to take that first and move the bill.
First, we need to move the bill. Would somebody care to do that? Representative Morrow? Next time. Representative Morrow. Moves House File 1803 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Okay. And the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Morrow, as well. Would be on line 1.10, change the A to an N, and insert two words, unaccredited religious.
Everyone get that? Okay. Any questions on that? I guess it's self-explanatory. Okay. Representative Morrow moves the oral amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And opposed? The amendment is adopted. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And obviously, that amendment was to narrow the scope and hence the cost and the fiscal note for the bill. But this bill, members, was brought to my attention last summer, actually, by my constituent, who's going to tell her story in a minute or two about what I would consider an oversight in the state statutes with after hearing her story. And that is that, as this committee, I'm sure, knows better than I do, since you're the higher ed committee, and I haven't served on this committee for quite a while, that when we are considering the state grants, there's a subtraction if you have credits in another state, even if you're not asking to transfer them to Minnesota for your record, and even if those institutions didn't participate in the state grant program. So this would just make those kind of credits that students like my constituent took in another state be treated the same way as if she had taken those credits in the state of Minnesota. And I think, Mr. Chair, if at this point we could hear her story, that's what made it clear to me what I'm talking about here.
Okay, we can do that. Identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. My name is Hosanna Reinhart. I am a constituent of Roseville, and I was forced to go to an unaccredited religious institution due to my parents' religious affiliation. I did not want to be excommunicated from my family, so I went ahead and went to the institution. I did a four-year program in 3.5 years trying to get through it. Unfortunately, because it is an accredited religious institution, my elementary educational degree is as worthless as the piece of paper it's on. And I don't need the state of Minnesota to okay my credits because I know it was an unaccredited institution. However, I have tried to move on and get an education that can support my family and that is worth something that I can use to help my family along. And however, I don't have a lot of finances. I have some, and I do use them as well as I can. But the grant money did help me my first 2 quarters in school. However, I'm not allowed to have them any longer because while the state will not allow me to use my credits for a job, they are wanting to, because of the way the bill is worded, say that I cannot get a grant to help me get an education that would be worth something. I really would like to be able to continue to get the grant, because I could really use that money to further my education. I want to be a paralegal. I'm currently going to school to be a paralegal at Rasmussen College in Blaine. I take online classes since I have 2 young daughters. and that I take care of at home. And I'm hoping once my daughters are a little older that I can possibly go on to law school. But for now, I just want to complete my two-year degree at Rasmussen. But the grant money would really, really help my family out. And other than the small area about my unaccredited religious institute, you know, religious credit, I am fully able to get that grant. So if you would please consider changing it, I would really appreciate it. And so would my family.
Thank you, Representative
Browning. Mr. Chair, and just to make clear, if this school that she went to that wasn't accredited and she's not planning to use any of those credits and can't, if it were in Minnesota, then it wouldn't have counted against her qualifying for the Minnesota State Grant Program at her new school that is accredited, but because it was in Indiana, it does.
Someone want to come down and comment? Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Minnesota statute says that you cannot get a state grant if you've already had 4 years of post-secondary education or the equivalent. And we are different from many other states in that that is the requirement. Most other states would do it based on how long a student had received a state grant. But Minnesota law says it's how long they have had attended post-secondary education. The exclusion that would exclude the unaccredited schools in Minnesota was adopted to address a different constituent concern some years ago. With the author's amendment, this would have a much more limited fiscal impact. I can't tell you what it is on the fly, but it would be much more narrowly drawn. I'm not sure exactly what other matters you might like me to address with this.
Anyone have questions of Ms. Grimes?
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rucabino.
Ms. Grimes, so the only real fiscal impact here is maybe give out one less state grant over the next biennium with the rest of the money you have left.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucabino, if this bill became law, we would give out a few more state grants, but it would be a limited number.
Okay, thank you. I guess that's it for questions. Any further comments from the author?
Mr. Chair, I just thank you all for your time and consideration, and hopefully with the narrowing amendment, this will be able to be included should there be a bill or whatever happens in this committee.
All right. Then it'll be held over. House File 1803 will be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Rucabino, please come forward.
You want me to present your bill, Mr. Chair?
I realize it's kind of a low chair, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, it's a hard chair for me to fill. There's no doubt about it. And we're in recess until further notice. Out of recess. Here we go. Representative Norris.
I'd like to move House File 1990. And
Mr. Chair, would you like this to be held over for possible inclusion or go right to the floor?
Let's see. This will be part of our omnibus bill, too?
Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
All right.
Chair.
Thank you very much. This bill clarifies the authority of MNSCU to continue operations during a state government shutdown. And I believe there should be an amendment in the packet.
Representative Norris moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the order he wants it. Are there any questions on the amendment? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is on. Representative Norris.
You're very efficient, Mr. Chair.
I used to do this for a living.
All right. We have Laura King here with us to talk about this bill this afternoon. And I think that this is a good piece of legislation that will help in the future in case we ever have another possible shutdown. Would you like to proceed?
Ms. King?
Thank you, Representative Norris and Mr. Chair. I'm delighted to be here today. I'm a little disoriented with you in front of me and Representative Norris to my left, but as we were visiting beforehand, there's a couple of church hymns that come to mind in this circumstance, but we'll pick the right one later. Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and thank you as well for your co-authorship of this bill, along with Representative Norris and Representative Morrow. We're here today with what we think is a straightforward proposal to improve the statutory position that's been supported by two previous governors, clear up confusion that hurts our ability to communicate with students and the employers we serve in the summer months, level the playing field between the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, private colleges, and for-profit colleges, and allow access to funds that we already have on hand without the need for any additional appropriation. The objective of the amendment is to clarify current law's force and effect. It would provide us clear access to already appropriated receipts. It would provide technical and administrative support to us through our relationship with Minnesota Management and Budget. And the amendment that just went on the bill was offered to us by Minnesota Management and Budget to provide additional clarity about their follow-on authority. And it would provide us with clear continued operational authority. Minsky has twice argued successfully that existing law enables us access to tuition and fee balances that are held in the state treasury. This argument relies both on 136F and 16A. 136F-74 provides the board with carry-forward authority to carry its balances forward from one year to the next and from one biennium to the next. And 16A-1286 provides authority for Minnesota Management and Budget to bill us for payroll and accounting system support. They also bill us for some technology support that we provide, and the amendment today just clarified that Treasury services are part of that relationship. And then finally, 135A directs the board to take all necessary steps in the event of a financial emergency to strive to provide uninterrupted student services to students. In June 2001, the Department of Finance signed an agreement with us enabling us to access cash for payroll and vendor obligations. We were then at the cusp of a similar shutdown. In the end, this agreement was not used because there was a higher ed bill passed, as you recall, Mr. Chair, very late in June that resolved our problem. But had the agreement been necessary, it would have enabled us to continue serving students into the summer. In mid-June of 2011, Governor Dayton included Minsky in his legal filing, citing our statutory and practical financial autonomy and our balance carry forward authority as the rationale for allowing us to remain open as we approach the end of June. In both instances, we were required to invest considerable legal and executive and board time to make the case and communicate with our public and our employees. We host the Office of Enterprise Technology on 19 of our campuses, and those services are not only higher ed services, they're state government services, they're public safety services statewide, cities and counties all use pipes and servers that the state administers but are located in our buildings. We have customized training programs that run 12 months a year. serving over 6,000 businesses, and needless to say, summer is a very busy time for us. In the event of a shutdown, we would have been forced to cancel those contracts and no doubt deliver tremendous hurt to the businesses that we have relationships with. Our students had paid tuition and fees as we moved into summer school this spring. We could have been in the position of having to refund tuition, refund financial aid, and likely damage the students' financial aid relationship because of federal requirements. In early June of 2011, we had over 100,000 students already registered for fall term, and the May, June, July period is when we enroll for fall term. And were we not able to stay open, that would have had a catastrophic impact not only on our fall business, but those students are often lost to us then forever. They've gone to St. Mary's, they've gone to the university, they've gone to Rasmussen, they've made another decision in their interest, and we would not get them back. We also had hundreds of international students that were both overseas on internships or here in Minnesota with us living in our dorms. And we were scrambling to understand what we would do with those students were we forced to close our dorms. Our situation is further complicated by the mix of our labor agreements. We have about 35% of our employees are in AFSCME, MAPE, MMA, and other statewide units administered by Minnesota Management and Budget. But that means that 65% of our employees are faculty in labor agreements that we administer. There was tremendous confusion in June about who spoke for what union, who issued which layoff notices, who had recall rights, and this would enable us to avoid all of that confusion and distraction. The proposed language would provide explicit authority for MMB to maintain our access to payroll, vendor services, and treasury, and preserve our relationship as a provider of statewide IT services to city, county, and state government. We would pay MMB a daily rate for those services, calculated on the basis of the $1.1 million we now pay them annually for those services. The amendment that you saw today recognizes treasury services as an explicit service that we would pay for, and it authorizes MMB to the extent necessary to move resources to the Office of Enterprise Technology. We think this proposal is in the state's interest, and we hope for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the week before the shutdown, I was at Bemidji State, Itasca, Central Lakes, Alexandria, Mankato, South Central, Normandale, and I heard from students at every one of those places how desperate they were that a shutdown would throw them off as much as a year in their education. I'm not crazy about autopilot bills, Mr. Chair, but Chair Nornis, I did sign on because I think this one's different. I think it's different in large part because the students have already paid for the services and the money is there, and it's just a matter of accessing the money, as Ms. King said. So for that reason, I think this is an exception to the autopilot bills that we've seen otherwise.
Thank you. Representative Pond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the length of time that you would anticipate. As I recall, it seemed like there was, when you got the approval to be able to be open, there still seemed to be kind of a sense that, but this will last us only a period of time because then our money actually won't be available. Ms. King, could you give me a little bit more information of that?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Poppe, you're absolutely right. There was tremendous uncertainty as we were in June. And we were talking with our board really every day and doing modeling about how long could we go before we started to hit other triggers. And we got satisfied that we could have completed fall term. If presuming nothing else happened, there was no higher ed bill, with some cash conservation strategies, we got satisfied that we could complete fall term. But it's that's a disaster planning of a first order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree. I'm one to say that I don't think we should have shutdown. That shouldn't be an option for us. We actually should be looking at trying to come together and figure things out so we avoid that. But will this actually change so that you would be able to continue to stay open as long as you have money, or just as long as the shutdown lasts, or is there one or the other? So if the shutdown would last longer than you actually have money for, will this keep the doors open and keep students being able to attend through that length of time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, what this allows is explicit authority for us to access our receipts. That's all it allows. So if nothing else were to happen and there were no higher ed bill, there was no new state appropriation to us, we would be managing on our own receipts until they were exhausted. And then we'd be bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Other testimony from the audience? Jeff, do you want to come down? Come on down. Thank you, Ms. King.
Yeah, all right.
Mr. Detbrunner.
Chair Rukavina, members, thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon. For the record, my name is Jeff Dipperner, president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. Our organization represents over 100,000 students of the public two-year community technical college system. I'm speaking to you today to share our enthusiastic support for this bill that allows MNSCU to continue to serve students in the event of a government shutdown. As a part-time student, I've taken summer classes each year I've attended Minneapolis Community and Technical College. I'm unable to attend full-time due to work obligations, so I've made it a priority to take summer classes to stay on track for graduation. I can say with certainty that if I had not been able to make my class last summer, that I would not be graduating this spring. I'd have to spend another summer or even fall semester finishing up my degree and delaying my future plans. And my story is not unique. In fact, around 47,000 students in the MNSCU system were enrolled in summer classes in 2011. These are folks who, just like me, want to get an education and move on and join the workforce. A shutdown or even uncertainty about whether or not the MNSCU system can operate is especially devastating because students may choose a more expensive educational option, accrue more significant debt, or forego or leave college altogether. I think he stepped out, but I just want to thank Representative Morrow for his comments about the difference between MNSCU and other agencies. MNSCU is very unique in that our students have paid tuition, as you've heard, and we're already progressing through these degree programs. And if they're interrupted or threatened, as I mentioned, it could result in a delayed graduation and, of course, you know, a general fewer college graduates for the state of Minnesota. This bill will give students assurance that our educations will not be interrupted by government shutdown and we can continue to make progress towards college completion. A MNSCU shutdown will hurt students and hurt Minnesota. Please support this bill and support it in this committee and on through its signature by Governor Dayton. Thank you. And I'll stand for any questions.
Any questions, members? Okay, if not, just a comment by me, Mr. Chair, and members, and that is that there are a lot of different constituents of ours who got hurt during that shutdown, and a lot of unique situations, and I see there's a lot of bills, whether it's for hunting or fishing licenses or for the zoo or, you know, a number of other bills that are attempting to address the pain that people felt because of the shutdown. But there are a lot of people that felt a lot of pain, and even in certain circumstances with families that need help with handicapped individuals, etc., that felt a lot more pain than hunting and fishing licenses or going to the zoo. And I don't really see where a lot of those are being addressed. I think Representative Poppe said it best when she said we should all come together and not have a situation where we end up shutting down government. But, you know, it's all about compromise, and sometimes folks don't know how to compromise. So you got a good bill, but there are a lot of other situations, including me, that could tack on some amendments to this, Mr. Chair, to address some of the folks. We have, you know, IRRRB doesn't get any state money. It owns Giants Ridge. We had young students in a string violin piano program that we've had for years by some very, very well-known famous artists from around the world. We had kids from Belarus, Soviet Union, Brazil, that were staying at the
Giants Ridge little dormitory we have there for skiers and that, that you know, they were 14, 15 years old, and we're going to kick them out on the street. We just left them there. But we, you know, there are all these kinds of circumstances that happen because of the shutdown, Mr. Chair.
This has been a learning experience for me, too. I didn't realize how much leeway the chair had for editorializing, so.
Mr. Chair, I got the gavel. And the chair, when the chair has the gavel, he can do anything. I'll tell you a cute story. Pete Fagina was my predecessor. He gave the gavel to another range legislator, and he killed his bill. Okay, with that, then, we're laying over House File 1990 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Representative Nornes now has House File 2377 that he moves for possible inclusion in the omnibus
bill. Same motion. Thank you very much for that. This is another important bill that I think is probably overdue. This creates a tuition reciprocity account where appropriations for reciprocity programs are deposited and from which reciprocity payments would be made. There's also an amendment, Mr. Chair, that we'd like to offer at this time, the A3 amendment.
Representative Nornes moves the A3 amendment to get the bill in the order he wants it. Are there any questions on the A3 amendment?
This amendment simply changes the effective date.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Nornes.
All right. Thank you. Right now, if we have a surplus of money coming to the state from a reciprocity state, which we do in the case of Wisconsin, that additional revenue goes directly to our state's general fund. If we have a deficit, as we do with North Dakota, the Office of Higher Education must find that money within its budget in order to satisfy that requirement. The Office of Higher Education will be taking almost $4 million from their state grant program now to cover the North Dakota deficiency. That money should be going to students, and hopefully this bill will be helpful. If this bill is in place this year, the surplus from Wisconsin will cover the cost that's owed to North Dakota, allowing about $4 million more to be then benefiting students. That's basically the bill.
Questions on the bill? Representative Poppy.
This likely, I don't know how to say this, but this has happened in the past where we've had an increase by one, a deficit in the other, and so this has happened for a number of years. What is prompting it at this point? Spill.
Well, I think in my case, this is the first that I've really become aware of this imbalance. And it may have happened before. I don't know if the chair has encountered it before. But because of the size of the imbalance, it seemed like, of course, the general fund would like to have the $12 million or whatever the number is. But at the same time, the Office of Higher Education can't really afford to find $4 million to spend either to satisfy the deficit. So it right now makes sense to do it. It should have been done probably before. It just didn't happen. So that's the best answer I come up with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there will be then a hole in the general fund if this happens, because they were receiving the increase, but they weren't. The general fund wasn't paying the cost. So, is that planned for in a different way? And just curious about.
Well, Representative Poppy, let's get Ms. Grimes up here to see what she says, because I don't see a fiscal note here.
Yeah, there's one.
Is it in the pack? Well, I don't have one in front of me here. But, you know, and how they'll count it then, because there is always confusion with reciprocity agreements, with in-state tuition at one school where we don't count it as an expense, but other ones that don't have that, you know, language, then we count it as an expense. So, Ms. Grimes, you want to walk us through this?
Mr. Chairman, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. The fiscal note was drawn to the bill before the amendment, which the author put onto it. And that the bill basically said that money would continue to cancel at the end of each fiscal year if it weren't needed to pay North Dakota in this case. If it's all right with the chairman and sure. Representative Norris, I'd like to pass out a chart here that kind of shows how the reciprocity payments have changed, have fluctuated over the years. One of the things that is likely to happen with tuition reciprocity is we currently estimate that we will have to pay North Dakota. I'm trying to find my notes here. $4.7 million, I believe it is, or $1.7 million in fiscal year 13, $5.5 million in fiscal year 14, and $5 million in fiscal year 15. We expect that while Wisconsin paid Minnesota about $9 million, we'll pay Minnesota about $9 million in fiscal year 12, that will go down to $2.4 million in fiscal year 13, that we are likely to get no payment in 2014, so it would be zero that year, and that we may have to pay Wisconsin as much as $1 million in 2015. So the payments do fluctuate over time. But it is certainly true that right now the money going out to North Dakota comes from the Office of Higher Education's appropriation. The money coming in from Wisconsin goes to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, then what will happen when there's no money coming in and everything's going out and you don't have a balance to be able to, maybe I missed how that works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, if you look at the chart, until about 1997, where both lines are above zero, Minnesota was paying both states, was paying both Minnesota and both North Dakota and Wisconsin under tuition reciprocity. Since then, we have continued to pay North Dakota, although there were some years when it was zero, and Wisconsin has been paying us. And the dotted lines are our projections for what we estimate the receipts will be going forward. If we thought we had to pay both states, we would ask for appropriations that would be sufficient to pay both states. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
It answers the question.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically, what I understand is it comes out of the general fund if we have a shortfall, but if there's a positive balance, the positive balance will be transferred to the general fund. Is that correct, Ms. Novak?
Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrow, with the amendment on the bill, and it's the first two lines of the amendment, the balance doesn't transfer back. It's okay. Builds up in the account.
Is Ms. Grimes, there's no fiscal impact during this current biennium, this bill?
Mr. Chairman, if possible, I'd like to answer that question in two parts. The first part is what it would have been without the amendment. Without the amendment, we believe the impact on the general fund would have been $920,000 for fiscal year 13 because we would have not been able to transfer the unspent state grant money to cover the deficiency in the appropriation for fiscal year 13 for tuition reciprocity with North Dakota. With the amendment, the money coming in from Wisconsin would certainly be sufficient to pay North Dakota in fiscal year 13. I assume that somewhere on MMB's books, however, they would have an equal decrease in money that's generally available in the general fund because that payment from Wisconsin would no longer be available for general purposes. It would be only used for the reciprocity.
Representative Moore, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, there are two issues here. I agree with Representative Nornes. I'm concerned that the payment that's going to North Dakota is a result of the rationing that happened in the state grant program. That we limited payments in the state grant program, we ended up with a positive balance of $7 million, and that's, lo and behold, where we're finding the $4 million to now send over to North Dakota. So, to me, it seems that the money should stay in the financial aid programs, generally state grant program specifically. And I Ms. Grimes, I completely respect what you're saying about the years when we have negatives to both. But in a situation like this year, it seems perfectly logical to me that if you're paying out of the state grant program to the states for reciprocity, any positive income you get, say, from Wisconsin should go back into the state grant program, that the two should be balanced. And the fact that we haven't done it for years and years doesn't mean we shouldn't correct the situation today.
Representative Norris, would you want to comment, or Ms. Grant?
I just agree 100%.
Okay. Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norris, if this is included in our supplemental bill, would it not then be a finance bill? And I have a couple of other questions, depending on how you answer that.
Representative Norris.
I hate these trick questions, Mr. Pawlowski. But I guess you're right. It would probably be a finance bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, then it would go to Ways and Means. It would open itself up in this committee and in other committees and on the House floor to, I think, a series of rather unique amendments if it is a finance bill.
Representative Norris?
Representative
Pawlowski, the fiscal note just came, I think, this morning, and they didn't anticipate that. They thought it would be a wash, but you are correct.
Mr. Chair, I'm not asking about what was. I'm asking about what is.
And what
and
is,
I prefer
right.
to deal with the present.
Yeah.
Representative Norris?
You may be right. I don't know. I don't have an absolute.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, this is money from the general fund, significant dollars that are being shifted into a special fund. And I don't know how to characterize this in any other way other than it is a fiscal bill. I'm trying to understand, Representative Norris, what this supplemental bill is, if it's purely policy or if it's fiscal. I don't have a preference either way, but I certainly will have an interest as to which of the two it is when the bill comes before this committee, when it comes before Ways and Means, and when it comes to the House floor. That's, you don't need to answer, but I think other members will have an interest
right.
also.
Well, it started out as policy. That's all I do.
Yes.
But we have a ways to go yet.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to Ms. Grimes, with this graph that you sent out, just if you would explain to me the huge steep increase for Wisconsin to go up above the zero line. Why are we anticipating
Ms. Grimes?
That?
Mr. Chairman, we are estimating that the payments from Wisconsin will go down. The calculation of the payments between states depend on a number of factors, including the number of students from each state that go each way, the marginal cost of instruction in each state, which has been negotiated to be defined as 64% of the average cost of instruction, and the amount of tuition students pay. Minnesota students attending in Wisconsin pay higher the tuition they would have paid if they had gone to a similar institution in Minnesota. That, generally speaking, is substantially higher than the tuition they would pay if they were a resident of Wisconsin attending that Wisconsin school. So what they pay covers a larger portion of the cost going between states. One of the other reasons for the fact that the payment for Wisconsin may go down is that there are starting to be, in certain counties, declining numbers of high school students coming out and going into some of these campuses. So all of these factors come into play, and it is actually possible that a relatively small change in the number of students and the tuition paid can make a swing of several million dollars when it comes to the payments to and from Wisconsin.
Okay. No further question then, Representative Norris, any other comments to wrap it up?
I think we probably have covered it.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, what would you like me to do here? Just say that we have no further business then, that the meeting is adjourned, or?
Well, first of all, this bill needs to be held over for possible inclusion.
And you had moved that, so
yes.
we're at that point. Clear. We're ready for
okay.
that.
Then I think we're pretty well done with our agenda.
Oh, okay, well.
You can wrap the gavel.
Mr. Chair, we'll be in recess until I re-adjourn now. I'm meeting adjourned.